Happy Friday, everyone. Welcome to Lunch Talk Live here on NBCSN. I'm Mike Tirico. We have no fun, no fancy stuff because the show is so good. We need to get right to the show. We have a lot of champions here. We have Andy Reid, the Super Bowl champion head coach from the Kansas City Chiefs, is coming up. Sebastian Coe, who won two Olympic gold medals in the 1500 meters and is the president of what was the IAAF, which is now World Athletics. It's the governing body for world track and field. He will join us about the Olympics, about track and field, all that other stuff. Paul Azinger, Ryder Cup champ, and of course the PGA champion in the past, will join us. We will discuss the TaylorMade Driving Relief, which comes up on NBC, NBCSN, and Golf Channel this weekend. And Dale Earnhardt Jr. will join us to talk about the return of NASCAR. All of that is coming up, so the hour is full. We want to get to Mike Florio first from Pro Football Talk. Mike, there was a pretty interesting couple of news items with the NFL that I want to delve into quick at the top here just to get some news out there. And this is this whole Steelers situation with James Harrison, the hit on Muhammad Massaquoi of the Cleveland Browns back in 2009, the $75,000 fine, and the comment that Mike Tomlin handed him an envelope with that, which the Steelers have come out and in the name of Art Rooney, denied what happened. This is a very odd and bizarre story. How do you see this playing out as whatever investigation might happen does happen?
Well, I think as a practical matter, nothing will happen. Sean Payton, the Saints head coach, who bore the brunt of the Bounty Gate situation in 2012, right, has said publicly he doesn't expect anything to happen. Look, I believe anything that occurred before the Saints suffered their punishment in 2012, the NFL isn't going to go down that rabbit hole. It's been plugged with cement long ago. And I understand what Harrison's saying. I understand the broader context of the NFL at the time this happened. Look, the NFL was going through a difficult transition back in the days of discovering the problems with concussions, Mike. And there was that moment where it was in real time. Three devastating hits, bang, 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 on the same day. And Harrison's hit was one of them. And the Steelers thought it was a legal hit. Mike Tomlin thought it was legal. Art Rooney thought it was legal. James Harrison thought it was legal. And when we consider that time that it took for teams to accept it's a different world now, it's really not all that implausible that a coach may be tempted to put money back in the pocket of a guy who had money wrongfully taken out of it in that coach's view.
The hard part here, Mike, is that, you know, you're 11 years past the incident, and you're asking Mike Tomlin, who's had a very good reputation with his players within the league as part of the various committees, including competition committee. You're really putting Mike Tomlin in a very difficult spot when this something like this comes up. How do you answer those charges from a James Harrison at this point if you're sitting in Mike Tomlin's chair?
Well, you know, either he did it or he didn't do it. I think it's that simple. There's no middle ground here. He gave him an envelope or he didn't. It had cash in it or it didn't. And Harrison kind of doubled down today. He's pushing back against the reaction to what he said about the envelope because people have compared it to the bounty scandal. Harrison says, look, Tomlin never told us, go hurt somebody and I'll give you money. But in explaining it, kind of like the way I did, that back at the time, players and coaches thought this was BS. They didn't like this. They thought it was wrong that the NFL was doing this to players. That provides the context for a coach maybe saying, look, I want my guys to play the way that I want them to play. And if every once in a while the league office is going to disagree with how we're playing and take money out of their pockets, it's on me to put the money back in. So, I mean, the circumstances make it plausible. At this point, you're right, though. 11 years after the fact, what can you really do about it? But I think at a minimum, the league should talk to Mike Tomlin, should talk to James Harrison. I just think they don't want to open up that can of worms because nothing good comes out of picking at a scar that has healed over years ago.
Before we get to Dale Earnhardt Jr., I want to hit you on one more point, and that'll be the news coming up later this afternoon. Aaron Rodgers is going to meet with the media. Now, we've seen a lot of players, a lot of quarterbacks here meeting with their local or regional media, but because of the drafting of Jordan Love, this is a different kind of conversation. People have been waiting to hear from Aaron Rodgers. I'm sure there'll be a lot of folks with ears tuned to that teleconference, video conference, later on this afternoon coming out of Green Bay.
Oh, I think it's going to be fascinating, Mike. Get your popcorn, get your scotch, and get ready to listen to Aaron Rodgers. And I want to hear him get pressed on the things that Brett Favre said publicly, because Rodgers has only spoken to Favre. And Favre on multiple shows, Rich Eisen and on Sirius XM NFL Radio, he has said some very pointed things basically acting as a surrogate for Aaron Rodgers. I want to know, does Aaron Rodgers agree with the things Favre said? Does he refute the things Favre said? And we'll see what kind of things that Rodgers said. You know, he's a smart guy, though. He's going to be very strategic and tactical in what he says and what he doesn't say, and it's going to be very fascinating.
Yeah, he's real smart. So that'll just tee up a weekend when there is some real sports to talk about as we go forward. The Rodgers news coming out of that press availability later this afternoon. Mike, thanks to see you on Pro Football Talk on Monday morning, of course, at 7 a.m. Eastern. Thank you, buddy.
All right, pal. Good talking to you.
Florio hops in for the news update in the NFL. Now let's get to the weekend. And as we said, live sports with the golf. We'll talk to Paul Azinger about that in a bit. But NASCAR returns to Darlington on Sunday with a Cup Series race there the following Wednesday. And then it's next weekend in Charlotte. So this is real sports. It's really back on the track. No fans. A lot of different things about it. But it's happening. We've talked to a ton of drivers all week. Let's get the last word on our week. Looking ahead to the weekend from the man himself, Dale Earnhardt Jr. joins us. Dale, what are the folks saying about the reality of getting back on the track on Sunday as we now get closer to it actually happening?
Yeah, it just doesn't feel real. It's hard to believe we're going to actually sort of kick the season back into gear. And I know that, you know, there's a lot of apprehension because of the way that we're going to do this. Nobody's going to get any practice. There's going to be no qualifying. Literally the first laps that these guys have ran in months will be under competition once the green flag drops. And you also have guys in the field. Think about Matt Kenseth. He hasn't drove a car in quite some time, coming out of semi-retirement, and will be suiting up and driving the number 42 car for Chip Ganassi. And he's going to have to go into turn one on the first lap of that race, having not drove a car in a long, long time. It's extremely exhilarating and nerve-wracking at the same time, but it's what these guys live for. They're looking forward to it. It's a really long race. So that plays into their hands where they will be able to, take the majority of that race, the first half of it at least, to sort themselves out, get themselves up to speed. And as a driver, I know within 40 laps, 50 laps on the racetrack, you really are back in the saddle. You really are back in the swing of things and comfortable in the car. So there's just so much, though, that can go wrong. Without practice, without qualifying, the teams are going to have to guess on the setup. So this track's very abrasive, very rough, and it's going to destroy the first couple of sets of tires. Literally in about 10 laps of this race, that first set of tires is going to be gone. And these guys are going to be hanging on for dear life until that first competition caution comes out to be able to put another set of tires on. And that second set will be just as vulnerable. That, to me, is the most compelling part. What these guys are going to be dealing with and struggling with in that first few laps.
Kyle Busch was on with us yesterday, and he said it is almost like I'm going to go into that first turn at about 50% and just try to ease your way. And almost like the mentality that you see when we talk Daytona 500 or in the other discipline, the Indy 500. It's so big, so much bad can happen early on. Just let it sort out. Can you have an entire field of guys who are just being patient and sorted out when nobody's been behind a wheel for about 9 weeks?
Not everybody will approach it the same way. And I will tell you this, yeah. I would be very similar to how Kyle's going to approach it, because Darlington's a really tough, narrow racetrack. And when you're damaged and half speed and not able to run competitively, you're spending the entire 400 miles just getting out of the way. It's almost the most, it's just really frustrating, not a really good experience. So you don't want to damage the car early in the race by mistake, by making your own mistake. The track's going to be completely green, really slick. They run right on the fence there. You're going to have to be careful not to hit the wall, not to damage the car early. And if you have to give up a few spots in that first 10 laps just to understand what your car can do and can't do, it might be the wisest decision you make all day.
You were a great driver, but you were also incredible with your warmth with the fans and your popularity. I'll never forget one of the moments I'll always cherish was walking through the crowd at Daytona with you, and just so many people just wanted to just see, there he is in person. So for the drivers, they're going to be missing that. Yeah. What kind of an adrenaline rush, seeing the fans, what kind of a factor has that been in your career? What are the guys going to be missing out on Sunday?
That will play a huge role into the psyche of the race car driver. The fans bring a ton of energy. They remind you of what you're there and why you're what you're competing for. that people are entertained by this, that people are wanting you to do well. When all that is gone, it can give you a false sense of that this might not be as critical or as important. I think it's going to be smart for the drivers to try to really pump themselves up. That fan interaction and energy is not going to be there. They're going to have to find that somewhere else within themselves, their team, their crew chief. They're going to need to be pumped up to be to understand that this is a race to win. There's a trophy on the line. There's points. There's repercussions to finishing well or bad, and this matters towards, you know, the ultimate championship goal at the end of the season. So you can't go in there and look around and when you don't see fans there, think, well, maybe this isn't as important as it would be in other circumstances. So I think you can kind of trick yourself there. And it's going to be the weirdest experience that they've ever had as drivers. They've never been in this situation before where they're not getting any laps. They're going to jump right out on the track and can try to complete the race. No one's going to be there to celebrate it, to enjoy it. But under the circumstances, we need to get back to the racetrack. We need to get back on the track and get our sport moving again. We need to get money moving again in our sport to survive, to help these teams survive, to help the sport survive. So it's critical that we do this without fans under the circumstances that we have today.
Dale, have you heard a lot of conversation, whether it's team members, guys in the pits, or drivers, with a concern about the health and the COVID-19 concerns that everybody seems to be having as we're trying to slowly return to some normalcy here?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of concern for sure, and that's human nature to want to stay healthy. And some people go about that differently. Some people have a different frame of mind about what they need to do to keep themselves healthy, how serious they want to take this this pandemic. So you may see people with different interactions or different social distancing measures. And you see that when you go into a grocery store or anywhere, you see people that react to this differently and handle this differently. And that's the same thing you're going to see at the racetrack. Although NASCAR is doing everything they can to sort of educate everyone on what they expect. And I hope that this goes well. We don't need any setbacks. We want to be able to get this season started and be able to continue it eventually with the hope that we can bring fans back into the racetracks to be able to enjoy what we're doing. But until then, we need to get our sport going or we won't be able to have a season whatsoever. So we can't take a loss on this year. We need to go ahead and try to complete the season if we can. And NASCAR's doing some extreme measures. You know, we're going to race Sunday at Darlington, then turn around and race there again Wednesday. We're going to do double headers throughout the next several weeks at some of these tracks like Charlotte and so forth and Homestead possibly. So it's going to be a weird sort of vibe, but, at least we're going to – I mean, when you hear that first car crank up and pull out of the garage and drive up onto the racetrack, it's going to be like hearing it for the first time. It's going to be the best sound that any of us have ever heard in a long time.
You sound ready. Dale, so I'm thinking about this, and I saw a coffee with Kyle, our friend, colleague, Kyle Petty, speaking to the king, to his dad, Richard Petty, about what's ahead. That's available on NBC Sports digital content, by the way. It's really great. It's like 10 minutes to listen to Father and Son chats. It's really neat. But Richard Petty said, this is an opportunity for the sport, and the sport has to get it right. As someone who's got such a high place in the sport and it means so much to you, what is the opportunity for NASCAR, Dale, to get back in the sports vein in this first weekend returning to sports? An opportunity maybe to get some fans who used to be NASCAR fans back under the tent here over these couple of weeks.
Well, I guess the one thing that for me that I could compare it to is the 1979 Daytona 500. The entire Southeast or East Coast all the way up north was snowed in, and NASCAR was having its very first the second flag-to-flag race covered on national television. The first one was in Greenville Pickens in 71. But anyhow, this is on a big network. We're sort of introducing ourselves to most of the country. We had a very small bubble of a fan base, and we're trying to grow and become nationwide, and this was a great opportunity for us, and it succeeded. We had a great race and a memorable finish. So it's kind of similar to that, as we will be kicking off our season or kickstarting our season again, where a lot of sports are still on the sidelines. But it's going to be interesting. I think it's a great opportunity for us. I'm just concerned that we get going, that we do this the right way, that we keep everybody healthy, that we have great races. You know, the numbers and the finances when it comes to viewership and all those things, that, you know, it's second to just doing this the right way and having success with it. And then think about in the fall, and every sport that we know is going to be on TV or fighting for television time. That's going to be really interesting to see how sort of everyone's jockeying to get coverage and remain relevant among just, I mean, every sport that you can imagine probably will be trying to accomplish something in the fall of this year. So that's just going to be a wild show.
A head start and a little bit of connection with fans will help NASCAR when the calendar does get a little bit busier. Matt Kenseth, is on the Dale Jr. Download. Check out that Kyle Petty, Richard Petty conversation as well. Coffee with Kyle. Great talking to you. We look forward to seeing the race, and we'll be in touch next week.
Good to hear from you, Mike. Man, you take care.
You too, bud. Dale Earnhardt Jr. joining us there. Andy Reid still ahead on the show. Sebastian Coe as well. When we come back, Paul Azinger will join us. We'll talk about TaylorMade Driving Relief this weekend, the other return to sports. Our other analyst, Zinger, going to join us after this. TaylorMade Driving Relief, Sunday, 2 o'clock, not just on NBC, but NBCSN Golf Channel as well. Rory McIlroy and Dustin Johnson, you see the charity they're playing for. Ricky Fowler and Matthew Wolf play for the CDC Foundation. So between the nurses, the CDC, those foundations will be getting north of $3 million in great, important funds as golf, which always is at the forefront of giving back, gives back as it gets back on course. We're joined by Paul Azinger, who will join us on the broadcast. These are my favorite interviews. I have no notes. I have no plan.
Me neither.
We just get to talk here for about 10 minutes. It's good, right? I just want to make sure we're on an even playing field for once. So that that works out pretty well. What's your excitement level for seeing this, Paul, for seeing these guys, this format, and a return to live golf for the first time in 9 weeks?
Well, that's my biggest excitement, the live golf part and the fact that we all get to see Seminole. I've played it many, many times, and I know what Seminole is all about. It's going to be a fun course for the viewer. I think a lot of the people that love the game of golf know all about Seminole, may never get to play it, Mike. But it's a fascinating golf course. It's right on the ocean. The ball scurries along on the ground. It scampers all over the place. And there are just devilish bunkers that sit below the greens. And they really eat the ball up if you don't hit a quality shot into the greens. It's a great driving course. It's a simple driving course. We're going to see some bombs by those four players, but it's a real demanding second shot course. Hogan and Jimmy DeMeritt and Claude Harmon, Butch's dad, would go to Seminole to prepare for the Masters because it has that kind of shot quality to it. Crazy. It was built in 1930 by Donald Ross. There's been a few slight restorations done to it, Mike, but I think the reason it's going to be so great to watch is because of just the whole historical nature of the golf course and the fact that it's one of the best golf courses on the planet. It should be fun.
Routinely top 15 in the world, never seen in a live broadcast, so we're excited about that aspect of it, the charity aspect as well, and also seeing these teams of PGA Tour pros. I'm going to work in reverse order here for a second. I'm going to start with Matthew Wolf, who at 21 already has a tour win, has an NCAA championship under his belt. A lot of the general sports fans, not our hardcore golf fans, may not have heard much about him. What would you tell folks about Matthew?
Well, you know, yesterday we had our media kind of conference over the phone there, and you know, I think Matt Wolf was, I think it hit them all yesterday, really, that this was going to be a big, big deal, Mike. And I know it hit Matt Wolf because some people were asking him, why are you even in it? There were people questioning why he would be in this thing. And that's got to be some added pressure for him and a little bit of burden of proof for Matt Wolf. But I heard Crenshaw the other day describe his forward press is like a slingshot. And that is kind of what it's like. It's like this motion, like whack, whack. He has a big kick start. He won NCAAs and then came back and won, as you said, right on the PGA Tour, like his fourth ever tournament on the tour. He's got all kinds of potential, but a very unique swing, big time across the line at the top, and just the opposite of Ricky Fowler, who's big time laid off at the top. I mean, their clubs are probably pointing at the top of their backswings, maybe 60 yards apart.
That's a pretty good point. That's a pretty good visual with their two swings. During your career, Paul, you know, you kind of make the jump, whether it's a Ryder Cup team or you become a PGA champion. You start to find yourself with the best in the sport. And you all of a sudden look around and you go, man, I'm with these guys. What is that feeling like when that happens to you as an individual?
Interesting that you would ask me that, because for some reason this morning I was thinking about my first ever PGA Tour event at the Phoenix Open and the feeling that I had on the putting green seeing Trevino and Weisskopf and Nicklaus and Watson and Raymond Floyd. They were all there and it was intimidating, I tell you. It was really intimidating. I didn't think I belonged there, but, you know, I lost my card and had been through a few years of heartache with respect to golf. And eventually your self-belief gets to a point that matches your confidence. And, you know, it's hard to hold a guy back. These four players that are going to play in this thing on Sunday are going to be four of the most confident players on the planet, even though they haven't played in weeks and weeks. Dustin Johnson and Rory haven't played at all. Ricky and Wolf have been playing quite a bit, and actually Ricky and Rory know the course like the back of their hand, so a good thing they split those two up or it would have been a whitewash. I think it's going to be a good match, and it might come down to just what Rory and Ricky can do, because it takes local knowledge to play that course. But these guys are confident. They're going to strike the ball well. They're going to get a lot of good quality shots. And then, of course, Seminole says, I dare you to attack me, because if you do, you're probably going to pay a price. So we'll see with this format. They just want to make birdies, you know, how they're going to go about it. But their self-belief reached an all-time level, Mike, and that's the reason that they've been selected to come and do this and try to raise money for a great cause.
Yeah, and with Matthew Wolf, even though he doesn't have the pedigree, the length of time out there, the confidence of winning as a rookie, winning the NCAA, which is hard because college golf has become really, really deep and good. And on top of that, he's got a friendship with Ricky Fowler, both Oklahoma State. So there's a little bit, if it can be a comfort zone for him, being with these guys who have accomplished so much more. Let me go to the guy who's accomplished the most in terms of majors and is currently number one, and that's Rory McIlroy. It felt, Zinger, like Rory was in position to have one of those kind of years. How much of a challenge is it going to be for him to kind of put those pieces back together over the next few months to be in position for that run a little bit later in the season when we start to get to the tour playoffs and the majors as well?
Yeah, the hardest thing about golf is picking up where you left off when you have a bit of a break. You know, Tiger's probably the best at that, I think. You know, he could take a week off and then come back out and play good. He could take a month off and play well. He could win back-to-back weeks and then win again. It's just a remarkable feat. But Rory's got a mindset. I felt like last year at the Open Championship in Ireland that he kind of underplayed the value and importance, and it backfired on him. He was more nervous, and it meant more to him than he was willing to admit. And now it seems like Rory wants to admit that he's nervous, admit what these events are meaning to him. And I think it's a positive for Rory McIlroy and his mindset. He's a beautiful player, Mike. If you stand there and listen to the ball come off of his irons with his wedges, it's a sight to behold. He's become a clutch putter thanks to Brad Faxon. And he drives it as well as anybody on the planet. It's a great combination. He's going to hit a lot of wedges at this golf course at Seminole. And he may be able to make a lot of birdies, but Rory's a world-class champion. He's a great guy, and it's hard not to root for Rory McIlroy. But he feels pressure like maybe I did or somebody that doesn't achieve quite the way he has. He's, you know, I always say sometimes it's what you overcome that matters. And for Rory, he overcomes pressure every time he wins. Right. And a guy like Tiger seemed like he had a complete handle on it. It doesn't bother Brooks, but it affects Rory, and that's why when he does win, it means so much to him.
A lot of us who golf have played skins, but these skins games, and you've been a part of them. What is it like for tour players at that level playing for that kind of money in a skins format?
Well, the pressure is always on the putter. It comes down to the putter, and you got Ricky Fowler, maybe the best putter ever. I mean, best putter on tour now, best looking, flowing, fluid, smooth looking stroke. I mean, he hits no doubters, doesn't he, Ricky Fowler? And Faxon's been working with Rory quite a bit, and he's starting to look a little bit like Ricky to me in his rhythm and the way he approaches his putts. But skins games always comes down to the putt, and those are some of the tricky screens in the world to putt on. Rory and Ricky are putting the best of the four of them, and they know the green's the best. So I think they'll be the two guys that will end up being the most clutch. It's just what I think.
And we didn't talk about number one in the world, Dustin Johnson, number one in the world in the past, now number five in the world. Yeah. But all that talent, and anytime he walks to a golf course, there's a guy who you can say he can shoot 63, he can win any event at any time. Last one, Paul, I asked Dale Earnhardt this in the last segment. For the sport of golf, the chance to get out there, this event, the event next week, and then four events starting in about 4 weeks with no fans, golf will be out there before some of the other sports. What kind of an opportunity do you think that is for the PGA Tour?
It's a great opportunity. You know, all the players are going to have to be tested. The caddies are going to have to be tested. Everybody that shows up on site will have to be tested. And then they'll still obey the social distancing rules and guidelines and all that, Mike. But golf's an outdoor game. It should be able to be played. And I think, you know, in the end, you know, we just all have to mind our germ intake, I guess, and just try to stay, you know, as healthy as possible. And, you know, just keep washing our hands and doing what we got to do. The human beings have proven that they'll do anything to save other human beings, and we've done it. We've all quarantined. We had healthy people quarantined for this, and golf has a great opportunity to come out and say, hey, look, let's get back to it. I don't want to sit around the house anymore waiting to get sick or to not get sick, and I think we're all ready to bust out the door. Got to do it safely, though.
A lot of folks have used golf to get themselves out the door. Yeah, a lot of folks have gotten themselves out the door with golf, and it's available in all 50 states now, so we'll get to see the best in the world back at it, and maybe that'll be a little bit of a boost for the tour here as it comes back. All right, talk to you on TV on Sunday. Look forward to it, Zinger.
Got it. Thank you, Mike. Good being with you.
Okay, same here. Rich Lerner, Paul Azinger, Steve Sands, Jerry Foltz, Gary Koch will join us on the show when we join you Sunday 2 Eastern on NBC, NBCSN, and Golf Channel. More to come. Stay with us.
Every spring, you got a different Hawaiian shirt. How deep is the closet?
Tommy Bahama deep. You know, I am deep. Give Tommy Bahama a couple plugs, and they'll have this right on there. Socks, shirt, pants, I've got it all.
Well, the many shirts of Andy Reid, it has become a parlor game. As a matter of fact, our production crew was taking a little bit of a pool to see what kind of Hawaiian shirt Andy Reid would be wearing today as he joins us now. You got nothing. So they're all losers, Andy.
Well, that's it. I'm down here in my cold basement, so I've got a little something different on.
You get you something warm.
Yeah, that's right.
First off, congrats on the Super Bowl. With some time here, Coach, to reflect on all the times that you put into it, all those early mornings, all those game plans, all that stuff. Was there a moment here after February and March or April that it did really sink in that you finally got to the top of the mountain?
Yeah, so the pandemic set in right afterwards, so I think I got one free hamburger from it, but other than that, it set in from the fact that we know we won the game, and that's where you get most of the satisfaction from. That, listen, we got in there, we battled our tail off, and we end up winning.
Yeah, and it was a memorable game for Chiefs fans everywhere. I'm going to go someplace a little bit different with you here. I want to talk about quarterbacks. Because obviously you've got Patrick Mahomes, but you know, you go back through your history, back to Lavelle Edwards, who meant so much to you at BYU, and you and Mike Holmgren going from there to the Green Bay time. You've always been around great quarterbacks, and then Philadelphia, and now developing them here with Patrick and Alex Smith's success. What are those intangibles, Coach, that you look for in a quarterback that gives you a chance to have somebody at that position who can lead and win?
Yeah, I think if you take all those guys, they're smart and they love the game, and when you combine those two things, I think you get with their athletic ability, you get this great player. And I've been fortunate to have been around those guys. The one thing, I guess, another thing that's universal with them is they have good vision, so they can see see the field, and that ends up also being very important.
And Patrick has shown that, and all that great talent that he worked so hard at over the years. Just to come back to last season, as you were going through that season and the run, was there a point where you felt that this team came together to a level that, okay, we have everything it takes now, not just health, but also mentality to be a Super Bowl caliber team?
Mike, I thought it was down when we were in Mexico. We had a chance to play the Chargers. Chargers were hot at that time. We were we were kind of up and down, and we had a battle down there. We had to battle the elements as far as the altitude and the weather part of it, and then the noise. And so our guys pulled it together, and I thought offensively, defensively, and special teams wise, we played well.
This is 22 consecutive seasons for you as an NFL head coach. You've seen this whole league change in so many different ways. What do you like about where the league is right now in terms of the on-field product?
Well, it's exciting football right now. I think offensively, it's exciting. I think it's the great defenses that force the offenses into being more creative. And then at the same time, it picks the level of the defense up, so that they've got to stay flexible. But we're using the whole field now. And not that we didn't before, but we're doing it to an extreme. And you have these players, these kids coming out of college where they're throwing the football. They understand how to do that. You're not dealing with kids that are in the I formation running the football every down, throwing it maybe on a third and long. So you're dealing with kids that are throwing first, second, third down. They're doing it in high school. They're doing it at the college level, and we've got that product coming in to the NFL right now.
And this is what I've always appreciated of the time spent around you. There's a constant research to where the game is going next. And you even brought in some significant coaching experience to help analyze where's the game going next. Did that help you take the West Coast offense as your kind of the foundation and build off of it all the college concepts and bring that to the NFL?
Well, I thought it was important. I thought when we got Alex Smith, it was a fresh start for Alex, that maybe we could give him something that he's ultra familiar with, and take him back to his heyday, which was his college time with Urban Meyer. So I said, well, let's pull out a couple things of that. And he's a brilliant guy, so maybe we can build off of that and start something that that puts his name on it and is special for him. And so that's what we did. We still kept some of the West Coast plays in there. We didn't abandon that, but we added to it with some of the RPO game and spreading people out and letting Alex use his mobility and talents to take care of business. Also, his ability at the line of scrimmage, where you can give him multiple plays to also use that part of his game.
When I was doing the Monday night games with John Gruden, I got a chance to spend a lot of time with you. And I always enjoy the stories of the incubator of some really brilliant offensive people. Steve Mariucci, John Gruden, you, Mike Holmgren. What was it like as all of you were trying to come up with the right play, the right twist on the offense there for that week, and to continue to grow the advancement of not just the West Coast offense, but all of you as individual coaches?
Yeah, well, we were blessed to have Sherm Lewis with us also, who kind of kept us all together.
Yes.
While Mike was being the head coach. But what Mike did was he challenged us to come up with new things, creative, innovative things. And then he'd make us battle each other to get it on the board and actually in the game plan. And so it was phenomenal. What a great experience it was. And I'm still very close with Gruden, and even though he's a Raider, still very close with him, and as I am with Mooch. And we still talk about all that stuff. And with John and I, we still share ideas. So he's got an unbelievable offensive mind. He loves the game and spends a lot of time at it. So when he talks, I respect what he's saying there.
And he feels the same way about you, as you well know. That start of the game, that 15-play script, those first 15 plays, is there a joy for you as a head coach, as a play caller, when you come up with the right plan and you map out, this is how I want a game to start as we're starting on the sideline. These are the things that I think can work. What is that? Take us behind the curtain on putting that together for a head coach or a play caller, I should say.
Yeah, sure. So you put that was put together so that you give your players a heads up on what you're going to call, first of all, out of all these plays that we have on the game plan sheet. And then you situate certain formations and plays to see what the defense is going to do with those. And then you go from there with it. So it's just an introductory part to the game. And it's not something that's necessarily going to win the game for you in the long run, but it's hopefully to get you off to a good start. And I didn't do a very good job of putting those together during the playoffs because we didn't have the lead.
That's all right. The next 15 and then the 15 after that did a pretty darn good job.
Yeah,
right. The draft, Clyde Edwards-Helaire, that's a player who really looked like he was an unbelievable fit for your offense. And your offense does so many things. What's that like in the decision-making process with you and Brett Veach, as you know you've got a Super Bowl-winning offense, an MVP quarterback? Do you add there, or do you go to the other side of the ball? How do you try to weigh those two things when you get into that situation on the clock?
Well, we were picking way down there, so which is a good thing, but not always a productive thing during the draft. So you've got to discipline yourself to take who you think is the best player at that particular time. Normally we don't take running backs in the first round, but here we're sitting with – with Clyde sitting there, and we're going, this guy is tremendous. Brett Veach, who does, he covers every base there is 15 times over, loved this kid. And every guy that he's loved has been a good football player for us.
And Clyde was such an integral part of what LSU's offense did with Joe Burrow as the conductor there. And obviously Patrick Mahomes does that. It's almost silly to ask, where can Mahomes get better? But that's what sports is about, self-improvement. What are the areas that you'd like to see Patrick continue to grow in as you get into this season with him?
Yeah, well, as Eric Bieniemy and Mike Kafka work with him, I just think he couldn't be in a better room. And then he is a sponge. So he wants to know everything, learn everything, and be challenged every day. And then he wants to go out there and take every rep he has and try to better his game, which makes it exciting from a coach's standpoint. So, as a quarterback, you're like a farmer. There's always work to do. And if you're into it and you stay humble, then you can get in there and you can correct yourself and keep working on perfection. And so he's been able to maintain that mentality. He calls me every other day and we talk. He's on the WebEx with the coaches every day going through things, and he just wants more and more and more, and he's passionate about the game. So, like I said, as a teacher, that's all you can ask for, because you're trying to give him one more thing. I mean, that's a great challenge for a coach, to give him one more thing to even make him greater than he already is.
Is it hard to still be a teacher as a coach, considering all the things that come with this job at this point?
No, I don't think so. I think we're here to teach. I think as a parent, we're here to teach. And now I'm a grandfather, Michael. Doggone it, I'm getting old, man. But I've got these 9 grandkids around, so I'm in that same boat. So, we're here to teach, and that's what we do. And I don't think it matters if you're a head coach or not. You're always learning, and then you're trying to share whatever bits of wisdom that you might have with the guys around you. And so that's how we roll.
That's why he's been so successful for so long. I'm glad Tammy set you up with a nice table down there in the basement. So you keep busy with your off-season program. Tell her we said hi and Stay healthy, Coach. And again, congratulations on winning that Super Bowl. You were a champion to so many of us in so many ways, but we're certainly glad that you can put the official title ahead of that.
Well, I appreciate it, Mike. You're the best, man. I don't think people realize all the stuff you do. You can announce this antique table that I'm sitting at right now and make it seem famous and interesting on top of that. So you're the best. I appreciate you.
You're too kind, Coach. Thank you. And we are at the point now we're going to start broadcasting tables and chairs because we've run out of all the things to talk about with no sports. Well, thanks, Andy. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, Michael. Thank you.
Andy Reid, coach of the Kansas City Chiefs, the Super Bowl champion coach. When we come back, Sebastian Coe, twice an Olympic gold medalist, but also the man who's in charge of World Track and Field. He'll join us when we come back. Well, you talk about a resume, or properly a CV, for greatness in this sport and connection to it. Sebastian Coe tops it. This from the 1980 Moscow Olympics, one of the two 1500-meter gold medals he won. Also two silvers in the 800 meters, 12 world records during his athletic career. Sebastian Coe, knighted in 2006, once a member of the British Parliament, and now the man who runs what was known as the IAAF, which now known as World Athletics, the international governing body for what we in the States call track and field. And Sebastian Coe joins us. It is a pleasure to be with you. Does that feel like 40 years ago, that 1980 gold medal?
It seems like yesterday, Mike, but I'm only relieved that it's not in black and white.
Yes, they had color and they had the time on the bottom of the screen and all of that. You've been such a part of the Olympic movement for so long in so many different ways. I'm just curious, as we sit here now in 2020, sometimes it feels like it's so big you can't get your arms around it. I know you're just involved with the athletics, World Athletics and track and field. But what is your position on where we are in the overall Olympic movement now?
I think the Olympic movement is strong. Clearly, it's been a very big setback not to have an Olympic Games scheduled when we were expecting it. You know, it wasn't that long ago I was chairing the organizing committee for the London Games. I can only imagine how I would have felt in March of 2012 if somebody had come to me and said, look, we've got this pandemic that's going to stop you from delivering what turned out to be the greatest games ever. I think I'm probably allowed to say that from a slight distance. So, you know, nobody underestimates the challenge of having to reschedule. And of course, wearing my World Athletics hat, that was one problem. But of course, you can't just lift one piece of the jigsaw out of the global calendar, which is a very complicated matrix, without the knock-on effect. So mercifully, we were able, with great relationships in Eugene, Oregon, the hosts of what were going to be our 21 World Championships. We've now moved those to 22, which keeps the Olympic Games and the World Championships apart in the same season.
And Eugene has done some great work with the facility there, and we'll see that hopefully for the U.S. trials as they come up next year, leading up to Tokyo, and then the World coming here in 2022. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, the championships in Eugene are going to be fantastic. It's really important for our sport to have a foothold, more than a foothold, in the U.S. And look, you are the largest sports, global sports market. Athletics needs to be there. And I think there's something else that's important, too. We need to use these championships and then looking forward to the games in L.A. in 2028. We need to use that time to really start building the one-day meetings. You are the powerhouse of track and field. You have been for a long time. You routinely come back with more medals in track and field than any other nation. But we also need to have the opportunities for American athletes to be, you know, to be earning their crust, to be performing in front of, you know, great crowds and audiences in the U.S. And at the moment, it's rather European tilted. So I'm hoping that we can really start developing more one-day meetings in the U.S., which is what you had in the past.
And when you speak of the Diamond League meets, we see that very often, and many of those have been rescheduled this year. But you see where the international power for that sport and appeal for fans can be. And these are some of the Diamond League scheduled events that you'll see during the rest of this calendar year, as everything has been shifted because of the global pandemic. I'd like to come back to the why. Seb, why do you think that the U.S., given all the talent, has not found that magnetic connection with the American fans for what we call track and field?
Look, track and field is a very strong sport in the U.S. It's very strong at collegiate level. It's very, very strong in terms of the global footprint. But when I was competing a long time ago, there did seem to be more opportunities for U.S. athletes to be competing on domestic soil. We love having your athletes in Europe. They add luster and sparkle to our events. But I would just like to see more opportunities for those athletes to earn a living domestically. And maybe we've all taken our eye off the ball a little bit here. And if you look at, we've got a strategic plan that we are working our way through at the moment, and a very key indicator there is to try and reconnect more American fans with track and field. We had the World Under 20 Championships in Eugene in 2014. They were hugely successful. We were then off the back of that able to take the World Championships 21, now 22. I think this is a really good platform. And NBC have been terrific partners and will be the host broadcaster for the championships in 22. And we have great relationships there. So I think it's not that difficult to reconnect, but I think we're all going to have to work a little bit harder at that and make sure that track and field, as you describe it, gets just a bigger shake in broadcast space.
I have only a minute or so left, a lot of other topics, and we'll have to revisit them at another time, but I want to get to one that is more timely. A bit of a welfare fund that has been set up because some of those athletes that we're discussing really have some challenges during this pandemic because no meets, no money being earned. So what have you folks been able to try to help set up to help those athletes in this tough time?
Look, it became abundantly clear to me, as you've said, no meets, no bonuses, no prize money. We're not able to replace every cent of that prize money, but there are going to be athletes globally that are really struggling. And when I say struggling, I'm talking about food, roof, clothes, the basic essentials. So we've created the fund, and we really do want to target those athletes that are most in need. We've targeted those that are likely to go to the Olympic Games in Tokyo. And we want to actually build that fund. It's standing at about $500,000 at the moment. We can build on that. And really, it's to provide a welfare network for those athletes who have served our sport well. And we just want to make sure that even a modest contribution can make a difference at these difficult times. It's what we should be doing. And I'm really pleased that our teams have got their heads around that.
Well, there are so many different topics, including clean sport, the Russian doping, that you have been in the middle of the conversations at World Athletics. There are so many different other topics. I hope we can get a chance to visit at a little more length some other time to delve into all of those as we get closer to Tokyo 2021. But thank you for joining us for a few minutes, and we look forward to seeing you not just in Tokyo, but hopefully before then.
I look forward to that opportunity, Mike. Thank you, and you stay safe.
Same to you and all of our friends on the other side of the pond. Sebastian Coe joining us. What an incredible resume. And he did mention being the head and the chief organizer for the London 2012 Games. And that's the challenge ahead with Tokyo. How do you put all those puzzle pieces back together? They've done it at the sport and the schedule level. Now they have to do it at the logistics level. And that's what America is doing this weekend as we turn the sports faucet back on in some ways. We'll have that TaylorMade driving relief Sunday on NBC, NBCSN and Golf Channel with the Golf Skins game, over $3 million to be raised. But also NASCAR gets started at Darlington. As we leave you on Lunch Talk Live, we leave you with Ken Squire and his reflections on a return to the sport of NASCAR here on this weekend. Be safe. Have a good weekend.
Engines, air guns, cheers, sheet metal. When a racetrack goes quiet, it's a noticeable thing. There was a quiet that rang through Daytona in those moments, and the hours that turned to days, waiting on news from the hospital. Sports turned aside for prayer and reflection and relief. Seeing Ryan Newman with his daughters walking close, hand in hand, a driver and his family striding toward a new day ahead. Such is life in motorsport. The thousands of drivers who circle hundreds of tracks know that in racing, the thrill of competition is sometimes stricken by tragedy unforeseen. Something invisible struck the world, and NASCAR was not immune. For only 4 weeks in the spring of 2020 did we witness the superheroes of the Speedway, with names synonymous with daring and intelligence at high speed. Johnson, Harvick, and Kyle Busch, and Hamlin, Logano, and Bowman brought spectators to their feet. It was something to see, indeed something to behold. Though racing was placed on hold, its spirit was not. In unprecedented times, we held our line under caution.
Green flag is up.
They'll be right up against the wall here at Darlington.
The wave of the flag and the sight of the line. Above that rattle of steel, the char of gasoline, burning rubber, the taste of sweat and tears. It is racing's enigma that the bond between driver and fan is a sense that is most strongly felt, elbow to elbow, door to door, hand in hand, heart to heart. The isolation of our times will not outrun our enduring affection for this competition and the community it rallies. For there is no other institution where worth, which should be measured by how far distant, instead reveals how it drives us and draws us so close.